Welcome to Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This week on Making Contact.
What the transnational corporations want to do, and in fact the domestic ones as well, is undermine democratic functioning, but ensure that there'll be a powerful state to subsidize them.
On this special edition of Making Contact, author and professor of linguistics at MIT, Noam Chomsky, discusses democracy and the common good with our national producer, David Barsamian.
In early January, you had the opportunity to address the Congressional Progressive Caucus, a group of about 50 progressives in Congress. How did that go for you, and what did you talk about?
Well, to put it a little more exactly, the 50 progressive members of Congress were part of the organizing group for the conference, but I don't know how many of them were there. I saw a few, but I don't know whether others were there. There was just a big audience, and it was part of a long meeting in which many of them came in, and I don't know how many, and there was a good, lively atmosphere and a good bit of vitality. I thought it was pretty encouraging. From what I could see, the event, looked, which wasn't all of it, it looked like a very pretty encouraging step. In fact, I thought it was kind of striking that it didn't get media coverage, since it's pretty rare that anything like that happens. I don't recall anything similar.
And the topic of what you talked about was entitled The Common Good. Can you talk about that?
Well, that title was given to me, actually, and I started by saying that's not a little, I'm a little puzzled by the title, but since it was given to me and I'm a nice, obedient type, I just talked about it. And I started from the beginning with Aristotle's Politics, which is kind of the foundation for most subsequent political theory, and pointed out that he assumed that a lot of it's about democracy, and he took it for granted that a democracy would be fully participatory and that it would aim for the common good, but that in order to achieve that, the democracy would have to be what we today call a welfare state, which would ensure lasting prosperity for the poor, relative equality, and moderate but sufficient property for everyone. If there are extremes of poor and rich, or if you don't account for, if you don't make sure that there's lasting prosperity for everyone, then you can't talk seriously about a democracy. And he went on to, and then I mentioned that that idea was runs right through the good bit of the tradition up until through the Enlightenment and classical liberalism, including the major figures like de Tocqueville and Adam Smith and others. You know, it's just kind of assumed Jefferson and so on. There's another point that Aristotle made which took a little twist in our own constitutional system. He pointed out that if you had a perfect democracy, this is kind of theoretical, his discussion in part, if you have a perfect democracy, and you haven't granted lasting prosperity to the poor, and you do have big differences of wealth, very rich and very poor, a small number of very rich and a large number of very poor. In that case, in a perfect democracy, the poor will use their democratic rights to take away the property of the rich. And he regards that as unjust. And if it is unjust, there are two possible solutions. One is to eliminate poverty. The other is to eliminate democracy. Well, James Madison, who was no fool, noticed the same problem. And whereas Aristotle's solution, you know, a couple of thousand years earlier, was to eliminate poverty, Madison's was to eliminate democracy. So he discusses quite explicitly in the Constitutional Convention that we have this problem, that if we do have democracy, then the majority of the poor will use their power to do things like what we would nowadays call agrarian reform, and that can't be tolerated. That would be unjust, since the goal of the primary goal of government is, in his words, to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. And he also, no fool again, pointed out that over time, as time goes on, this problem is going to get worse, because there's going to be a growing percentage of a part of the population that will suffer from the serious inequities of the society and will secretly long for a more equal, equitable distribution of life's blessings. And if they have the vote, they may do something about it, which is unacceptable, not for Aristotle's reasons, but because it would threaten the wealth and power of the opulent minority. So he therefore designed a system which is pretty stable, in which you would make sure that democracy didn't function, that, as he put it, power would be in the hands of the more capable set of men, those who hold the wealth of the nation, and the rest would be factionalized and marginalized in various ways. So that's one solution. The problem is real. Whether you decide it's a problem or not is another question, but the fact is correct. If you have a democratic system with large inequities of wealth, and the great majority is impoverished and doesn't have access to that, and secretly sighs for a more equitable share of life's blessings, in Madison's words, then they'll probably do something about it. And they have mechanisms in a democracy. That part is correct, which means they will threaten the rights of the wealthy to control the property. And remember, property rights are not like other rights, contrary to what Madison and other and a lot of modern political theory says. If I have the right of free speech, it doesn't interfere with your right of free speech. But if I have property, that interferes with your right to have that property. You don't have it. I have it. So the right to property is very different from the right to freedom of speech. This is often put very misleadingly about rights of property. Property has no right. But if we just make sense out of this, maybe there is a right to property. One could debate that, but it's very different from other rights. And it is surely the case that if the majority lacks the property and is suffering and secretly desires a more equitable distribution, they have mechanisms to do something about it. That's right. And as I say, there were two solutions. The classical one was to eliminate poverty. The one on which our own society was founded was to eliminate democracy. That's sort of worth understanding. And it takes various forms over the years, but the problem never ends. And we're facing it right now. I mean, if a democratic society were allowed to function, it's extremely unlikely that the things that are now called the inevitable results of the market would ever be tolerated, because they simply concentrate wealth and power and harm the vast majority, and there's certainly no reason for people to tolerate that.
As we sit here, the World Economic Forum is being held in Davos, Switzerland. It's a six-day meeting of political and corporate elites with people like Bill Great Gates of Microsoft and John Welch of GE and Benjamin Netanyahu and Newt Gingrich and on and on. The companies represented at this forum do something like $4.5 trillion worth of business a year. Against this backdrop of globalization and the growth and power of transnational corporations, what actions should be taken to reverse this process?
Well, it depends what time span and range you're thinking of. I mean, you read constantly that this is somehow inevitable, no way to stop it, like Thomas Friedman in yesterday's Times or whatever it was, people who just mocks people who say you can do something about this. Well, that's certainly not true. For one thing, we should be aware of the scale of globalization. In many ways, what's called globalization is bringing about a situation which is not unlike what it was at the early part of this century. If you look at gross measures, like, say, trade and investment flow, and so on, It's relative to the economy. It's getting back to more or less where it was early in the century. There are also changes. Like the one major change is the style of financial flows, which is extremely fast and overwhelms governments and so on. Okay, that's new. But there's nothing inevitable about that. That's public policy. I mean, it resulted from two major things. One, a decision to break down the system of regulated currencies, which is a policy decision made first by the Nixon administration, and another by the telecommunications revolution, which is just the normal form of public investment and public cost and of the public assuming vast costs and risks and then handing it over to private power to use. But these aren't things that are at all inevitable. The fact that the whole system is coming to resemble in many ways what it was early in this century, apart from things like this, that's been made in quite mainstream circles. Incidentally, it's not an unusual idea, though the differences are crucial, but under control. Now, beyond that, about three-quarters of the international transactions, like trade, for example, and investment and so on, are within Europe, United States, and Japan. Okay, these are all areas where, in principle at least, mechanisms already exist which allow the public to control what happens. That aside, transnational corporations are also a public gift. They were created, their rights, the rights of corporations altogether, were created mostly by the judicial system. They were granted extraordinary rights early in this century. The public doesn't have to agree to that. In fact, they don't have to exist at all. All of that's under public control. That aside, maybe we've talked about this, if you look at the top transnationals, they rely very heavily on public subsidy. In fact, according to the major study that exists, about 20% of them wouldn't even survive if it wasn't for public takeovers. Well, all of this is under control, in principle, up to the long-term goal, which I think has very deep roots in working class movements and Enlightenment thought, even in classical liberalism, that these institutions have no right to exist at all. They're fundamentally illegitimate. And they're not a law of nature. You know, in fact, their current form is rather recent. They can be changed like other oppressive institutions have been changed. So what are the limits? Without limit.
But where do you see the fissures? Where do you see those openings where popular resistance can be mobilized around?
Well, right now, without anybody calling for it, about 95% of the population, which is not small, thinks that corporations should sacrifice profits for the benefit of working people and their communities. Well, that's 95% is a good place to start. Now, I don't see why. Notice that call presupposes their right to rule. It says be kinder. 95% of the public thinks they should be more benevolent autocrats. All right, that's a place to start. Let's make them more benevolent autocrats. But I think that same 95% can easily recover and may indeed already have a point of view that has been articulated all the way through the working class movements, that they don't have any right to rule at all. It's not that they should be more benevolent autocrats. They shouldn't. There should be no autocratic structures. So to repeat what mill hands were saying around here about 150 years ago, those who work in the mills ought to own them. Okay. So we move from the idea that the autocrats should be more benevolent, which is correct and fair, to the question of whether there should be autocratic structures. And I don't think that's a long move.
What about this contradiction and paradox? On one hand, the transnational corporations undermine and subvert state power, yet they are highly dependent on the state for subsidies, for military protection, etc.
There's nothing novel about that. It goes back to what I've sometimes called really existing market theory, which means good for you, but not for me. You look through the whole history of modern economic development, and you find that those who advocate markets, virtually without exception, do it in that form. So if you look at the what the transnational corporations want to do, and in fact the domestic ones as well, is undermine democratic functioning, but ensure that there'll be a powerful state to subsidize them. I mean, if Gingrich represents maximization of free markets and undermining of safety nets, then we ask, how did he react when the Reagan administration carried out the most protectionist policy since the 1930s? Did he oppose that? I mean, how does he react when we closed off American markets to Japan to enable the automotive, steel, and semiconductor industries to reconstruct? Is he against that? And so we can go on testing how he really feels about free markets. Answer is, he's not on the integrationist side. He wants it when it's good for his guys. What about the other one, safety nets? Well, we can ask about that, too. If he's opposed to welfare dependency, then he should be certainly opposed to providing federal subsidies to his constituents he happens to be the champion in bringing them home. Well, it doesn't work very well. That picture is mostly mythology. The fact that one can get away with it is pretty astonishing. In fact, by now it's kind of interesting that they're almost open. I mean, they're usually on the business pages, but just right after the election, the Clinton administration, I assume the timing was not an accident, announced a huge program to build new fighter planes. They also knocked McDonnell Douglas out of the competition. So in our competitive aircraft market, it now goes back to Lockheed. It's now down to Lockheed and Boeing, with the indication being that Boeing would probably get the contract. And they also described why they're doing it, openly, but on the business pages. They said, look, we got to do this because we have to find efficient ways of making sure that the new technology and design and so on gets right to the commercial market. In fact, the writer of the business column pointed, or maybe somebody at the Defense Department said, we have to switch from a military-industrial complex to an industrial-military complex. That is, we have to now recognize publicly that really the point of the military production is to subsidize the private corporations. None of this is secret. It's right there on the business pages, some of it on the front pages. Nevertheless, we read that Newt Gingrich represents the anti-safety net, pro-integrationist position par excellence, that the fact that the U.S. regained control of the semiconductor and other industries shows the miracles of the market and nobody can avoid it. I mean, it's like a dream world.
Noam Chomsky, speaking with David Barsamian. We'll have more of that interview in a moment. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like a tape or a transcript of the show, or if you have comments or suggestions for future programs, please give us a call. You can reach us toll-free at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736.
In a Spring 96 Foreign Affairs essay written by Admiral William Owens and Joseph Nye, who's a former Clinton Defense Department official and now the dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, they predict that the 21st century will really be the U.S. century because of U.S. domination of media, and they cite the Internet and telecommunications.
They say that the U.S. has an unrecognized force multiplier in its international diplomacy and actions, and that I think the phrase they use is that this comes from something that people have missed, namely the importance and worldwide recognition of American democracy and free markets. And then the examples they cite are, without exception, cases of where the public has been deluded into subsidizing private power. That's as in the cases you mentioned, every single one of them is public assumes the risks and the costs and is Meanwhile, there's an elaborate deception scheme to make them think they're doing it because they're cowering in fear, not because they're creating systems of private power for the future. That's supposed to be an illustration of democracy and markets. And not only is that put forth probably without any attempt at deception, because it's so ingrained that people don't even understand what they're saying, but furthermore, nobody comments on it. I mean, that simply shows how deeply the real principles of the market are embedded, the real principles being fine for the defenseless, but not for the powerful. They need state protection. It's just taken for granted, and this article is a dramatic example of it.
I'd like you to talk about something that's described as equality of opportunity and equality of condition, and then the outcome.
Well, this goes back to Aristotle again. A traditional view, I suspect, a very major view, maybe dominant, in thinking about democratic and free societies since Aristotle has been that equality of outcome is a major desideratum for a just and free society. If you look at, in Aristotle it's explicit. I quoted some of the remarks. If you take, say, Adam Smith, he did advocate markets, had a rather nuanced advocacy of markets, but the argument was based on the assumption that under conditions of perfect liberty, markets would lead to perfect equality, which was the good thing, equality of outcome. If you look at another grand figure of the pantheon, say Alexis de Tocqueville, he had some illusions about American society, but let's put aside the question of whether his descriptions were true, but what he admired was the relative equality that he thought he saw. He somewhat considerably exaggerated it, but that was what he thought was good, that there was equality of outcome, and he pointed out quite explicitly that if you ever get what he called a permanent inequality of conditions, that'll be the death of democracy. Incidentally, he also, in other phrases that are not widely quoted, condemned the harsh manufacturing aristocracy that's growing up under our eyes in the United States. He said probably the most harsh in history, and he said if they get power, then we'll be in deep trouble. And of course it happened far beyond his worst nightmares. But equality, and the same is true of Jefferson and other Enlightenment figures and so on, for completely clear reasons, which has been discussed as far back as Aristotle. So equality of outcome is considered a desideratum. That doesn't mean that maybe not identity of outcome, but at least relative equality of outcome. That's what you're aiming at. Equality of opportunity, which is, first of all, mostly a joke because it depends on the opportunities, depend on the resources available to you and so on. But that's a sharp departure from the tradition of and acceptance of radical inequality of outcome. That's a very sharp departure from the core of the humane liberal tradition as far back as it goes.
One of the mechanisms to address this inequality of opportunity and condition is affirmative action, and that has been under a very severe and sharp attack, and in some states has been eliminated. What do you think of that?
It's kind of interesting. Many societies just take it for granted. So, for example, take, say, India. They have a system, I think it's called reservations, which was instituted at the time of independence, back in the late 40s, in an effort to try to overcome very long-standing and deep-seated caste, gender, and other differences. And any such system is going to impose hardships on some in order to, one hopes, develop a more equitable and just society for the future. How it works is a tricky matter. Has to be done. I don't think there are any simple mechanical rules for it. But the attack on it is though one, it's a mixed story. But and to a large extent, I think it's an attempt to justify the kinds of discriminatory and oppressive patterns that existed in the past. On the other hand, you can such systems should certainly be designed so that they don't harm other poor people who don't happen to be in the categories that are that are not designated for support. That can be done. In fact, there have been very effective applications of affirmative action in the universities, for example, and many other places in the construction industry and public service industries and so on. And I think there've been failures, there've been successes, but the main thrust of the program is humane and appropriate. You look in detail, you find plenty of things to criticize.
To talk about public radio and public TV for a moment, I mean, what's been happening is fairly transparent. They're being starved of funding from the public sector and being forced as a result of not having enough money to turn more and more to corporations for what's called underwriting.
That's true, but we again have to recognize the premises from which we're starting. Public radio and TV was a very marginal enterprise, never really permitted. There was a battle about this back in the 1920s and 30s, actually. Bob McChesney has done the main work on it. There was a struggle then, radio, as to whether it should be in the public arena or whether it should be handed over to private power. And it was handed over to private power in the name of democracy, which is kind of interesting. It tells you what a strange intellectual culture it is. In the name of democracy, we take the media out of the hands of the public and hand them over to tyrannies. That's democracy. And there's a kind of a contorted logic behind that. When television came along, it wasn't even an issue. Just gave it to them. There was a little fringe that was in the hands of the public. And in fact, as again McChesney points out, that's where most innovation goes on, exactly as in the industrial society. So say FM was public until it started making money, then it becomes private. The internet is a dramatic example today. Public, as long as you can't make money, becomes handed over to mega corporations as soon as it looks profitable.
That was Noam Chomsky speaking with David Barsamian. You can read more of this discussion in the recently published book titled The Common Good. It's published by Odonian Press. They can be reached at 800-REAL-STORY. That's 800-REAL-STORY. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, or if you'd like to make a comment about what you've just heard, that's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production funded by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. Our producers are David Barsamian, Denise Grob, and myself. Our senior advisor is Norman Solomon, and our executive director is Peggy Law. For Making Contact, I'm Philip Babbage.